off on way too much of a tangent, is a problem with Canadian society as a whole. We're all taught sort of de facto that we're all middle class, which is ridiculous. It's like, okay, and when you get down to it, what's middle class? Oh, it's if you have a home, or if you can afford cable, or you have a car. And it's like, okay, you're just talking about things. Like, it's not about the fact that a majority of Canadians are working class. Over 60% of Canadians are working class in terms of their income, but also power and agency in their lives and in their workplace. There's a small section of middle class, and then we have the capitalist class. But we're kind of taught, well, we're not taught about class, so everyone just assumes you're middle class. And in the classroom, if I have a student that's speaking up about their terrible working conditions, somebody else can put up their hand and say, oh, well, I don't experience that, and then go on to negate that student's lived working class or working poor experience. And as the instructor, I have to navigate that, right? I don't just shut the middle class or student whose parents are capitalists. I can't shut them down. But at a student worker center, that same student, like, I could even say after class, like, hey, you might want to check this space out. And then they go and talk about their lived experience, and other people are like, yeah, man, mm-hmm. I experienced the exact same thing. So Student Worker Center can create solidarity amongst, we know, like, when I was going to school, undergraduate, graduate, I knew that I was different from the students that had a lot of money, whose parents bought, I went to UVic for my undergrad. There were students whose parents bought condominiums, and this is in the 90s, so they must have made a killing on them later. Wow, in the 90s. I can't believe I just said that. Holy. Anyway, and their whole lives were completely different than mine. And we knew we were working class, but a lot of us didn't find each other because there was this assumed sort of middle class, like, oh, well, don't talk about that. And it's like, well, why not?
I think those were the main questions I had for this interview. If there was anything, though, that we didn't touch on that you want to mention that you think people should know about, what would that be?
I think that this is really exciting. Everybody we've talked to has been excited about this and sees the need. So that's really encouraging for us, I think, for our team.
Yeah, our team. Our team of two.
Once again, that was our conversation with Steph Ling and John Henry Harder, who are currently working together on the Student Worker Center initiative at SFU, which aims to provide a space for SFU students to get information on their rights as workers. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This interview would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. And we are back with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Hope you enjoyed that interview. Any updates on the Student Worker Center initiative will be brought to you here as they come along. But yeah, that was our interview with John Henry Harder and Steph Ling, who were kind enough to speak with me about this upcoming initiative. Coming up next, we have a piece more north of BC. This is coming out of Prince George from their LJI journalist Ian Gregg, CFUR Radio, CFUR. And it is about a UNBC student who is researching some unconventional gardening methods.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CFUR Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. Speaking in studio with us today is Courtney Dallaire, and she's pursuing a master's within the NRES, or Natural Resources Environmental Studies branch here at UMBC or the University of Northern British Columbia. And within that, she's looking at the ORTM, right?
Outdoor Recreation, Conservation, and Tourism branch.
Thank you.
But they don't put the, there's no C, it's ORTM, but the conservation's in there.
Right. And the conservation angle is what you're approaching with your project.
Yep.
Which you've just secured funding for.
Yes.
$26,000 over...
It's over the next year, which is good because I plan to finish up in the next year.
Excellent. And you're looking at unconventional gardening.
Yes.
As opposed to conventional gardening.
Yes.
As a path towards community-based conservation action. All right. Peeling into this layer, you're looking at interior of northern BC.
Yep.
Can you explain to us a little bit about the separation that you've put in your studies between conventional and unconventional gardening, just to lay that out for our audience?
Sure, yeah. When I say unconventional gardening, I don't necessarily mean like gardening that's really out there or kind of crazy gardening methods.
Not anti-gravity stuff.
Yeah, no, nothing crazy. I was thinking more of going against the conventional gardening practices, which is the use of herbicides and pesticides and kind of decorative mulches and ornamental plants and that sort of thing. So unconventional gardening, you could say it's more like organic gardening or environmentally friendly gardening.
And typically, I'm going to guess, with the intent to grow food for oneself or for others?
Sometimes, but I'm also hoping to look at gardeners that maybe just do flowers, and maybe they're just doing native flowers, or maybe they're focusing on maybe non-native plants, but hoping to increase pollinators in their area. I didn't want to limit the amount of gardeners that I had, and so I'm kind of looking at that more broadly.
You're still kind of figuring out who you can realistically talk to
exactly,
to get the data set for your research.
Yeah.
And the overall objective of your research. This is important. Can you tell us a little bit about
that? Yeah. So the overall objective of my research is I'm looking at how gardening can be used to give people steps towards living more sustainably. I think there's a lot of talk about different things that people can do to live sustainably. And a lot of those asks are way out of the scale of what people can realistically do. And I think gardening is kind of a seamless way to get people to live more sustainably if they can do that in those unconventional ways. I mean, there's literature that shows that people who garden, this sounds very simple, but people who garden, they care more about their environment because they're so involved with kind of seeing it at every stage. And I think that is really important of getting that reconnection with land, especially in cities. And, you know, Prince George is kind of different from most cities. It's very treed, and you want that reconnection to land because it's getting lost in a lot of ways.
And I'm going to guess that gardening is one of the ways in which people can experientially feel what it's like to actually either grow food or grow plants or have a connection to the environment, to nature. And you could do this on a large scale, on a small scale.
Definitely.
And it can be done in almost any place, given the right equipment or a few resources. It doesn't have to be an elaborate garden. It can be. You have that option.
Yes.
But it doesn't necessarily have to be. This is something that is relatively accessible for people to do.
Yeah.
Is there a limitation on the scale of gardening you're looking at? Is there a certain amount of acres that things shut off at? Or how do you rein in your parameters here?
Yeah, so the type of gardening that I'm looking at, you know, the size of the garden isn't so much what matters. I'm thinking for people that are doing it maybe as a full-time job like a farmer, I'll probably stop there. You know, people that are doing it kind of solely monetarily. I want to look at more people who are doing it kind of regardless of what they're getting out of it or not.
Gotcha. A little more about the parameters that you mentioned earlier. I'm thinking of the line between intensive commercial, say, gardening or agriculture and more conservation-based organic gardening. Where do you see that line? And is that line something your research hopes to better define?
I mean, yeah, one of the hopes with my research is that I can see how this kind of unconventional, environmentally friendly gardening can be supported and promoted. And you know, going up to those big industrial farms, they're necessary right now with the food demands that we have, but also kind of returning that back to the people that have the ability to grow food and returning that to smaller farms is, I think, a goal that a lot of people are on board with.
You're not really looking at, for example, within the world of, say, permaculture, how those different practices are conducted and done necessarily. You're more looking at what is your experience of gardening? How do you feel about it? How has it influenced your life in these ways?
And I will ask a little bit about their practices just to see when I'm promoting my research and looking for participants. I'll be looking for participants who kind of self-identify as environmentally conscious gardeners or people who care about the environment. And so when I ask about their practices, it'll be interesting to see what they're doing and how that makes them identify as environmentally conscious. But aside from that, no, I'm not necessarily going to be looking at, you know, their pruning techniques or anything like that.
It's not necessarily clearly defined what unconventional gardening really is or organic gardening really is. I think everybody has some idea of what that is, but in your research, you may end up asking each individual person about it, and they may have very different ideas about what organic gardening is or what conservation is. And these are interesting things to reveal throughout your research.
I think so.
Timeline, when you aim to have it all wrapped up, you said about a year, but...
My research is going to be conducted throughout the gardening season, which is, it varies. I'm hoping, you know, mid-May to maybe September.
That's just 2026?
Yes, 2026, summer of 2026. And then, doing my write-up in the fall and winter, and then hopefully done spring 2027.
Holy, you've got a busy summer ahead of you.
Yeah, I do.
Are you hiring help, or is this all you?
This will be all me.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this ties into the bigger picture of food security in northern BC.
Definitely.
A touch point.
So, I mean, food security in all of Canada has grown in popularity over the last little bit. But food security in the north is such an important issue, especially, you know, we have food coming in from southern BC. And if those highways are blocked for whatever reason, if there's, you know, a wildfire or a landslide or something, if food can't get up here, it would be nice to have other options to not just rely on things coming from elsewhere. And also, you know, with affordability and accessibility, all of that's really important. And I think growing our own food, or at least increasing that growth, is detrimental to that.
Looking at that dependence that we have in our region on importing food from other places so that we can get enough calories in a day.
Yeah.
Is that what inspired you to pursue this?
Partially, yeah. And I'm looking at, you know, the non-food gardening as well, because there's also that conservation side of things. But food is kind of like something that I'm just especially interested in, and food security. And I think it's also kind of one of those unifying forces of everybody needs to eat. And I think it's a fairly undisputed claim that people want access to healthy food.
In terms of conservation, then, what about gardening has drawn you towards that area of interest and expertise?
Yeah, so I've been a gardener my whole life. I worked as a gardener as well, and I've seen kind of both sides of gardening, where you have those very conventional kind of doing it to increase property value gardens, where it's kind of creating like a desolate, barren landscape where maybe it looks very clean and put together, but like nothing can live there unless you're tending to it so meticulously. And on the other side of that, a majority of the green space that's available in urban areas are private yards. And I think that that majority of green space, if all of that was used, not necessarily used as a conservation site, but used in a way that allowed for things to thrive, I think that could be a really good option for kind of resolving some of those bad effects that we've had on the landscape with development and that sort of stuff.
The research has yet to be conducted.
Yep.
And I don't want to pollute your end results by, you know, forcing you to take a position on something yet. But we're looking at independence of individuals to have their own garden, whether it be for food production or an aesthetic. To what extent do you feel that it enables people to have a little more agency day to day, not be so dependent on a more corporate method of, say, getting food or just satisfying the desire to have a pleasant aesthetic in your day to day life?
That's definitely important, I think. Like feeling like you have the option to choose what you want to choose is important. I think that kind of goes back to the too big of asks with sustainable living. You know, if I crack down on the gardeners and I say, you all have to do this and you have to garden in this way and you can only garden for conservation, they're not going to do that. And I think there's a lot of sustainable living asks that do that and tell people to do these things. And so I think if you give a choice and you offer support and you can find ways to support people to make those choices, I think those choices will come about.
So your research is coming from the angle of
qualitative, not quantitative. You're not as concerned with the metrics and the numbers as you are of the experience itself. Mm-hmm. Still within that, though, mm-hmm. how do you hope to measure what you're looking for?
The first part of my research is that I'm going to be doing interviews with people, semi-structured, so I'll ask them some open-ended questions, and hopefully they can chat at me about their answers. And I just want to hear about their experiences and the way that they feel about the land and the way that they use the land and kind of the relationships that are formed from their practice and what their practice actually looks like and if there's any constraints involved around what they feel they can and cannot do and if those constraints can be maybe not solved, but if there's ways that I could kind of alleviate those constraints, hopefully with the research. And the second part of my research, I'm hoping to give a few of the gardeners at the beginning of the season a reflective journal that they can write about after they've done gardening to see kind of those immediate thoughts after doing it, even just to show, you know, if there's a increase in mood, if people are saying, you know, I was angry when I started and I feel better now that I've done some gardening. I think that sort of stuff is really valuable, especially when I'm looking to find support in promoting this kind of practice.
I don't know to what extent you can speak to this at this point or not, but mm-hmm. down the road, are you hoping that the information derived by the research can inform certain policies or certain directions that a bigger decision maker can take? Or mm-hmm. what's your idea there?
I think that's the goal for a lot of researchers, is that this research will inform a policy that brings about better change. This is just my personal opinion. It would be nice if, you know, we banned more pesticides and herbicides and harmful things like that. And if there is a bunch of support for that in the community, something like that could be beneficial for better environmental practices, hopefully.
Right. People who are interested in your research,
yes,
and want to get involved, want to find out more, or maybe down the road, once you get your ethics approval and so on, maybe they want to participate, how mm-hmm. could they find out more? How could they get in touch?
If anyone's interested in, you know, hearing more about my research, or they just want to chat with me, they can email me at cdallaire@unbc.ca.
Speaking with us today in Seaver Studios is Courtney Dallaire, a master's student here at UMBC. She's recently received SHRC grant funding, which is the SSHRC, or Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada grant, to the tune of $26,000 to pursue her research here at UMBC, or the University of Northern British Columbia, looking into gardening as a path towards community-based conservation action. Courtney is in the outdoor recreation, conservation, and tourism stream of the NRES, or Natural Resources and Environmental Studies program. Best of luck with your research.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives program. Find our new
stories. We are back again with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. This is your host, Danny Nesvedarani, for the hour. Thank you so much to Ian Gregg and CIFA Radio up in Prince George for that interview. To end off this hour before Democracy Now! Right at 11 a.m., we have one more piece coming even more north of B.C. This is from Pam Hessen in Smithers, B.C.
This is CICK News. Caitlin Moon is a Chilliwack-based educator who traveled to Sikidak in March to teach IECE, or Indigenous Early Childhood Education, with a focus on birth and bonding. CICK News collaborated with Caitlin and the Sikidak Education Center to teach a class of 10 IECE students to create an audio documentary about birthing stories, which you'll hear snippets of later on in the show. The focus of these pieces are how varied birthing stories can be, and each student recorded, edited, and produced their own 3 to 8 minute piece in only 3 days. Let's have a listen.
My name is Caitlin Moon, and I'm an early childhood educator, and I teach the Indigenous Early Childhood Education Program for Nicola Valley Institute of Technology.
Okay, can you tell me a little bit about the IECE course, and specifically to the work that you were doing in Glen Vowel Education Center?
The course that I was teaching is focused on child development. It's specifically looking at children from conception to 2 years of age. And that was one of the pieces that was really powerful about this course is thinking about birth and bonding and what that, the impact that that makes for a child and their life.
Yeah, what did you think when you heard the pieces and the interviews?
I was really happy with the outcome of the stories, and I find that birth stories are so powerful. Like, it's something that, you know, a lot of people who have had children have a really emotional story, even, that they remember all these interesting details about it. So I found it to be a really great opportunity for the students to be able to explore that, and just such a wonderful way of how we can connect with the curriculum.
Mm-hmm. I was surprised actually at how much the students were willing to share, and even with their partners in the interview were also willing to share. That experiential learning, as you mentioned, skills sharing, kind of getting outside of your comfort zone in an educational way. What do you think that does for future learners?
I think it's a lot about developing the skills, because we can talk about theory and we can talk about, you know, topics like conception, and it can feel very distant, or it can feel very, you know, scientific or just out of our grasp when we're talking about cells and things like that. So when we're able to bring it into talking about a human experience, I think that we connect with it in a different way. And when I think about my experiences of going to take early childhood education, it was the more hands-on field trips and things like that that are the ones that come to my mind and what really shaped my perspectives as an early childhood educator. So wanting to create a similar experience for the SICKYDAC students, wanting to really support them in having experiences where the work matters and that they have that heart connection with it. It's not just the brain connection.
Caitlin, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me about this today.
Yeah, no problem. It's nice to talk with you.
Hello, my name is Allison Spence. I'm in the ECE program, and I'm doing an interview on Shantae Helen on birth and bonding. She has two babies, one girl and one boy. How is pregnancy for you?
Pregnancy for me was, it was good in the beginning, and like then towards the end it was like kind of rocky, and then the labor was like really long for my first one, so it was good and then rocky. My partner actually made sure he bonded while I was pregnant by like talking to my belly and reading like certain books and playing like classical music to my belly too, and like just always like making sure he was known to the baby or whatever, always talking to baby. And to me, I thought it was like kind of like I was thrown off guard because I wasn't used to that at all or anything, and then I got used to it, learned to love it.
With me, I just felt super awkward. I was like, hello, baby.
Yeah, like that's how I felt too. And then like I would more or so use my belly for like things like my bowl of cereals.
Did you find out the gender?
Yeah, I did. I really wanted to find out the gender for my first baby because I was too excited and anticipated to like wait it out like everybody else is supposed to.
Who had skin to skin first?
So with my daughter, my significant other had skin to skin first because I was having like complications down there, and they were waiting for the doctor to come in to like sew me up and everything while I was just like chilling there. And then the first time, when the first doctor came in, he didn't like sew me up right, so they had to call another doctor to fix his mistake and come back in. And then so my significant other had more skin time than I did, and then with like our second, I got skin to skin time like right away, and then he was like what about me? Like I was like, oh yeah, like you need skin to skin time too.
Did you plan on having babies?
No, I actually did not plan on having babies. They were complete surprises.
Yeah. So how are you doing now with everything? And
I'm doing pretty good, you know. And you get like a little hiccup in the road and you find another direction to pursue your dreams in your school, because like this is where I was going to go before I had kids, but that's what I was going to do, was to go be a teacher. And then my little babies came, and then now I continue on the journey, so. Pretty good, I'd say.
Thanks to my guest, Shantae, for taking the time to share her story with me. I'm Allison Spence for ECE. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Shantae Helene. I chose to interview Allison because I was particularly interested in her one story about her son. I really gravitated towards that and took an interest in that.
Mine would be with my son while I was pushing. He was almost out already, but his heartbeat was going fast, so they had to cut me. And then they grabbed him out, and the umbilical cord was wrapped around his neck. Mm-hmm. And both of us were like kind of blue and purple and whitish or something, but we both came through, and that's probably the most memorable one.
What did it feel like when one of your children were placed on your chest? What was the feeling like for you?
It was just joy, just because like the pregnancy felt like forever, and then like having them skin to skin with you was like so emotional that like, oh, I actually pulled through on this.
Yeah, because like you never know, right? 50-50.
Yeah.
Each labor. Would you be able to just describe how you felt after like baby was out of you? Like your feeling personally?
It was overwhelming just because I was just thinking about their future and everything. And
everything hitting all at once?
Yeah. So it was just kind of overwhelming. Like, oh, I have this little human being that I have to take care of.
Yeah. Did you have any worries or concerns about your child bonding with their new sibling?
But someone told me, when you have your baby's going to be bigger than you thought. And then also, you got to get her into trying to bond with them by like saying, oh, okay, you need to help me with this. So that helped me quite a bit because she's like, yeah, I'm in that role now.
Yeah, it gave her like be like a place. She felt like she had a place to help.
Yeah.
And being needed.
Yeah, and that she's still there.
Yeah.
I think so. She's happy about it after.
A new role to accept.
Hi, my name is Rochelle Wesley. I'm in the IECE course, and today I'm interviewing my fiancé, the father of my child, Gavin George. I chose to interview him to see the dad's perspective of birth and bonding and hear his side of the story of how he experienced everything as a first-time dad.
What were you feeling when, like, it was time for me to, like, go into labor and, like, give birth?
Well, I don't think it was too hectic. From what I remember, like, it was pretty easy. You knew when you were ready because you already went through this already, so I was kind of following your lead. We went to the hospital, they checked you, and it was just the time, like, I was just ready.
What was going through your head while I was giving birth?
It was just excitement and curiosity that took over. I was just so focused and watching everything and all that stuff that was going down. I was incredibly happy. It was just the best day of my life. Just having Cairo come into the world. It was just a beautiful thing just to witness and be part of.
Were you scared at all?
Not too much. I was just more focused on you and what was happening. So just with you and your pain and trying to be there for you. So I was kind of occupied. I didn't have time to.
Like, think about yourself or anything, just focused?
Yeah, just focused, honed in. That's kind of like how I am with everything, right? So
what was your like favorite part of that whole like the birthing process?
Just knowing that he was coming. The moment that he came out, like, the midwife, she was worried because his head was turned a certain way. That kind of scared me a little bit, but she corrected it. As soon as she corrected Cairo.
No, I thought he did it himself.
Did he?
Yeah, I remember he flipped and she's like, what are you doing?
Just did a somersault. Yeah. But that moment too, he just came out and shot into her arms. Like, there was no time. Like, I wish I was more involved to receive him. That would have been awesome. I wish I had a video of it. It would just happen in that moment. I was in that moment and just experiencing that whole thing. Just crazy how, yeah, he just shot out.
Did you feel like an instant connection with him, or did you feel like while I was pregnant, or like was it after?
As soon as he told me, there was obviously instant love because I was already ready to be a dad. I always wanted to be a dad. And I was just happy it finally happened, ready for him.
I would like to say thank you to my guest, Gavin, for taking the time to share his thoughts and his story with me. My name is Rochelle. Thank you all so much for listening.
To hear Rochelle, Shantae, and Allison's full interviews, go to smithersradio.com and find CICK Fresh at 12 p.m. on Sundays. Or tune in to 93.9 FM this Sunday at noon. Thank you to Allison, Shantae, and Rochelle for sharing your work with me, and to Caitlin for taking the time to speak with me about the importance of experiential learning in early childhood education. And a massive thank you to the educators, coordinators, and ICE class who all did wonderful work on this project. CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
This is Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Thank you to Pam Hassan and CSK News for that piece. And in about 20 seconds, we have Democracy Now! Right at 11 a.m., so make sure you stay tuned for that, as well as the other great programs we have today, from Raccoon City to Typically Tuesdays to Bitcoover and Slumber Party later in the evening. This has been Danny Nesvetterani. Thank you for tuning in.
Hi, I'm Amy.